delivering a capability the fleet needs at a cost we can afford. Today, we're on the airwaves to learn about SIMS at Sea, a relevant, real-time, cost-effective training capability designed to keep our warfighters ready in the operational environment. Welcome to Airwaves, the official podcast of the Naval Air Systems Command. I'm your host, Michael Lauren Prue, and joining me are some of the people behind this game-changing new standard for at-sea training. Please welcome to the show Captain Kevin Tripper McGee, Program Manager for PMA 205, Blaine Summers, Director of the Joint Simulation Environment at NOC-AD. Also from PMA 205, we have Mark McKennis, IPT Lead for Virtual Integrated Training, Johanna Matias, Virtual Integrated Training Chief Engineer, Renee Van Erp, Lead Systems Integrator for the SIMS at Sea project, and AJ Lawrence, Shipboard AIT Manager at NOC-AD Wolf. Thank you all for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So, Captain, tell us, what is SIMS at Sea? Where did the idea or the concept originate, and how did the team approach this unique challenge?
So first of all, thanks for the opportunity to talk about it. Pretty excited with what we've delivered recently to the fleet. So for the longest time, aviators have gone out on long cruises where they don't have the ability to get into simulators and train. And over the last couple of years, as we've advanced warfighting capabilities, this has become a real deficit for the fleet, where we're asking them to do more and more complex things, and they don't have the ability to practice it. So over the last couple of years, we've identified this as a big gap in aviation training. So SIMS at Sea is our first effort to actually put not just a single type model series simulator on the ship, but tie these together into an integrated framework where everybody can come and train together. We can execute complex missions. We can mission rehearse for things that might actually happen, because we never go flying alone. We never go flying by yourself in just your single airplane. So it was the first opportunity for us to link all these things together and deliver a real capability for the fleet. A little bit of background on where it came from originally. So we had started delivering single type model series simulators out to the ship. First was the F-18. Those got out to the ship in various numbers just to train by themselves. And I'll let Blaine talk here in a minute about the great work that they did to get F-35s out to the ship. And that provided an opportunity to really complete the air wing when one of our industry partners also, on their own dime, started to develop a smaller form factor simulator for an E-2. So as the NOC was doing incredible work getting some government-owned devices out to the fleet for the F-35, we came up with the idea together to go, and why don't we just integrate these all into a single capability that can be delivered and they can train together, which is what we did. Interestingly enough, one of the things that is challenging is it's actually defining requirements. We typically put requirements out for things 3 years in advance, go through the whole budgeting and planning process, and then you start to execute a program that might take a long time. The difference here was in about a period of a year from, hey, we think we can do it, let's go do it. We delivered something from an idea to actuality in about a year, which is really a testament to the team coming together and really tearing apart the way that we typically do things to deliver something that is making a difference today.
Yeah, thanks, Tripper. So building on the capability gap in the fleet, the first operational F-35 squadron for the Navy deployed on a carrier a couple years ago without any training available on the boat. So to Tripper's point, those aviators, their skills start to attrite the minute that boat leaves the dock. And that was the capability gap we recognized a couple years ago. That couldn't happen again. So CVN-70, the Vinson, was the next carrier to deploy with an F-35 squadron on it. And that's where we rallied the Warfare Center to go develop this government-owned F-35 training solution and get it out on CVN-70. And to Tripper's point, we really operated differently than any team I've ever been a part of. In less than 6 months, we deployed 4 F-35 trainers on CVN-70 for less than $2 million. We plugged that gap incredibly fast by partnering across the Warfare Center and with the right program offices to make that happen. Didn't have a requirement. It wasn't something that was funded 3 years ago, to Tripper's point. We just went out and did the right thing to close that capability gap. And so SIMS at Sea really built on that momentum. If we could do it for F-35, why not for the whole carrier wing? And that's what the team rallied to do.
It certainly sounds like an awesome effort to fill that capability gap. Looking at it now, what would you say is the true impact of SIMS at Sea?
We are learning that day by day as we go. We've got great communications with the air wing that are out there, really talking to them day by day as they use this. The end result is that when they go actually perform the duties we're asking them to perform, they'll be more ready and more able to do it.
Yeah, just to pile on there, there's the Warfighter Impact CVN-72 is on its way to the Middle East as we speak, and these aviators are training like they would fight because of the Sims at Sea capability this team delivered. Then there's the acquisition impact. Our teams here in the Warfare Center and the program offices learned a very different construct for delivering an organic capability to the fleet. It's something we don't typically do. We think of ourselves as acquisition oversight, shepherding processes. We delivered capability that plugged a near-term gap, and we're going to continue to build on that.
And I would also add that there's a longer-term vision that we're not sure of yet, but I would speculate that when CAG-9 returns from this deployment, they likely will be more proficient than they were when they left. And what that means long-term is that if you look at a normal workup cycle, carrier comes back from a deployment, you kind of just lose all of your skills, and we start all over going through the whole workup cycle until we go on the next deployment. They're not going to have to start all over again. They're going to get to that initial training cycle for the next deployment much more proficient than when they left. And if you can get to a point where every air wing has this capability on every one of our carriers, you will have changed the paradigm for training in naval aviation. It could be that big of an impact.
Now, Mark, as the lead for virtual integrated training, why do you think it's important we find creative ways to train our fleet for these complex missions, especially when deployed in operational environments?
The advanced capabilities that we're putting into our aircraft requires integrated training. You can no longer do it by yourself. And because we don't want to show our hand to the other team, you can't do it in the real airplane either. You have OPSEC reasons, you got range constraints and all of that. And so I think those are some of the bigger things that we came out with, knowledge and experience on how to do this better. And the fleet customer gets it quicker, and they get things they can really use.
So it sounds like this was a very collaborative effort. Let's talk about stakeholders. Who was involved and what role did they play in getting this capability to the fleet?
So the stakeholders were pretty vast, and I'll say probably the most important part of this whole enterprise was aligning on our goal. So working together in a small team and deciding that we were going to meet specific ship at a specific time with a specific capability, and we were going to go figure it out. We got all of the folks that needed to be aligned. That went from folks at the Pentagon to the actual fleet members to the folks on the ship. So COXO of the ship and the CAG and the deputy air wing commander all aligned to the goal and excited about it. So that's really prime importance to this effort. And I think any Get Real, Get Better effort is making sure you're aligned on what the actual goal is. And it was amazing to see stakeholders of all sorts, all the folks that play very critical supporting roles in making sure these things happen, were on board because they understood the mission, they understood the importance, and like Blaine said, we had a clear timeline. The ship was going to leave regardless of whether we were done or not, so we had to make it happen.
Totally agree, Tripper. And the other thing was command alignment. So we all rallied behind PMA 205 as the supported commander. It was NOC AD Pax River, it was NOC TSD, it was NOC AD Wolf, all bringing the right talent to bear to deliver on that capability. So while it was a small team, it was a diverse team bringing the right skill sets.
All right, so let's talk challenges. What obstacles did you encounter as you worked through this process, and how did you overcome them? Mark?
So the biggest challenge is policy, because we're working in a security environment that's very difficult to work in, and not a lot of people have experience in that. A very close second was the ship mods, which was caused by the policy problem. You have to get the space modified to accommodate these training systems at the proper level. We didn't necessarily have challenges with getting people motivated because everybody was aligned to that North Star. And this was something the fleet really, really wanted. So it wasn't hard to get that momentum. At the deck plate level, Johanna and Renee both had to overcome serious challenges. The technical piece of this, the integration piece of it, I would convey to them their thoughts on that.
Yeah, Beaker, I couldn't agree with you more on the policy perspective. Having such a disparate group of teams here. A lot of the policies were different across the organizations. And so trying to, from an IA perspective, for example, or from a security perspective, for example, trying to follow procedures that weren't the typical ones we were used to following, that presented some unique challenges for us. I think one of the major reasons Sims at Sea was a success is because of the get real, get better principle of elevate. When you encounter barriers, elevating those up to leadership. Now, I've worked with Blaine Summers for a long time, so I knew with him, I could always go to him. But this was my first time working with Tripper. And I recall bumping into him in the parking lot and just kind of unleashing on him some of the issues I was having from a security and IA perspective. And I will say within, I don't know, a day, I had seen improvement. So yes, those were probably two of the biggest hurdles encountered, but were quickly resolved.
So working with different IPTs, everyone's accustomed to doing business their way. So I think one of the challenges was kind of learning each other's language also and being able to lead them, understanding the milestones. And as I was seeing the big picture, I'd say, okay, this is a major milestone. And then just making sure that we all align to understand what that milestone was. So it was interesting learning all the different languages that you need to speak when you're speaking to an integrator versus when you're speaking to a lead ship mod person. So that was one of those challenges, was definitely language. And you felt it a lot also in security, because security themselves have different languages depending on where you're going, right? So I kind of support what Renee was saying, that we definitely had some growing pains working in that world. Other challenges, things that were normally simple became very complicated, very hard. We ordered a monitors that they ended up putting the wrong address. And one day to us was really 2 months. So time was a different concept for us. Things that normally we didn't have a problem worrying about, that it's going to take a week, to us it's 3 months. So time was a challenge.
Now, AJ, you were part of the shipboard integration team. What challenges did you encounter?
In our world, I saw it mainly as three challenges. First was the timeline. As they mentioned before, we had a very condensed timeline trying to fit all the critical milestones, no drawings yet from the planning yard, availabilities of the ship. Those availabilities would then change. That was definitely the biggest challenge from my perspective. The second one would be the overall scope of work and what we were trying to do. We're essentially trying to build a skiff internal to a ship. The scope of work to build out a space and that meets the security requirements for the trainers, for them to embark their system on board, is a almost never-ending list, it feels like at points. But we were able to communicate with 205 and the industry partners and TICOM and a bunch of other entities, the planning yard especially, in identifying those challenges, as many as we could ahead of time too. And that leads me into the third challenge, is the unknowns. This is a first time install. Even with a known install, every shipboard installation is different. There are always, from small projects to large installs, there's always something different. About midway through the install, we determined this is not going to get done in time. With the ship avail that we had, what was proposed, the unknown, the drawings getting delivered 2 weeks before we got on board. So middle of the install, we determined this is not going to get done on time unless we do something about it. So then the plan came up, let's send the installation team underway with the ship for a little bit over a month. And the work that they were able to perform on the ship, at least in my division, I've asked leadership, I said, have we ever worked to this magnitude while underway? They said, not even close. We had full industrial work going on, welding, electrical tie-ins, just a massive effort. And kudos to the team that actually went on board and dedicated a month of their lives away from their family. Within a week and a half, I think, the decision was made and implemented. It was great. And the collaboration effort was great.
So clearly communication was also a huge aspect of this. And I kind of want to go back, Johanna, to the coordinating aspect of this. How did you involve the customer, the fleet, the warfighter into this process? And what did that relationship really look like?
In training systems, involving the warfighter is very important. We want to make sure that we provide a product that actually trains them. As a lead engineer for many years, the first question I always ask the fleet is, what would you like to train? What are the requirements? So it is very important that we started with that. We asked them, what type of training would you need in this environment? Could you provide us an example of some mission sets? Could you explain to us what type of interactions you would need to collaborate with each other? So that was the foundation for us to understand what sort of training we're going to be needing to provide in this environment.
And Johanna, tell me about the importance of the relationships you built amongst the team and with industry. How is it vital to the collaboration that occurred?
I think any good relationship, the foundation is trust. And I think that everyone was focusing on the same mission and understood that when I was asking, it was out of a trusting perspective. I think it was building that trust that was really important. And that really solidified all of the relationships. In addition to that, when I went and asked questions or try to provide input to support tracking mechanisms, help understand milestones, et cetera, everyone was really prepared to kind of meet those milestones and also establish them as their own milestones. Renee and I had a couple of conversations as she was doing her integration, and she was like, oh, thanks so much, because you're really good at planning. So I appreciate that, because she was so busy trying to coordinate everyone and deal with all the vendors and contractors, et cetera. As she's doing the integration, I'd be like, okay, can we do this? And what about that? It was a lot of just every day getting on the phone, finding out, what can I do? My job here is to support you and making sure you're successful and identifying any pitfalls so that we can elevate and embrace the red. And then making sure that leadership gave us only support. There was nothing that we couldn't ask them that we wouldn't receive. Again, I think that everyone understood the importance of this mission, and there was nobody that wasn't ready to support us and make us successful. So I definitely want to give kudos again to the captain and everyone else involved that kind of took out any barriers. It was always about getting rid of those barriers. How can we help you? Every day we were always asked. I was like, okay, well, you know, that was fantastic.
I will chime in there, Johanna. The one thing we couldn't give you was time, and that was just impossible to change. You're absolutely right. Trust is critical. And for those other teams listening out there, this is not something that we really started out with as a team. There were areas when we started where clearly we did not trust each other, and we were not necessarily sure that the others had the same intentions and the same motivations. In some cases, they weren't sure of the requirement. In some cases, there was just miscommunication. So I think the transparency is key. I thank you for that, right? I thank you for bringing up those hard things, for not keeping things hidden. There are always unknowns, like AJ said, in the ship modification process and integration of different systems. Software always has a ton of unknowns. Anytime you try to do something, something's going to come up. And there were no issues that came up that folks were going to jump down people's throats about. It was always, hey, how do we learn from this? And how do we take the next step? Because we couldn't give you more time.
Now, throughout today's podcast, you've all mentioned several behaviors that enabled this to be successful: building trust, transparency, embracing the red, removing barriers. Blaine, I'm going to go over to you with this next one. How did the team think differently to deliver or achieve these results? And what were some of the key enablers to your success?
So going back to the beginning, we didn't have a formal requirement in the traditional sense. We didn't have a formal funding line. We had never done this before. To Beaker's point, this was a first of its type install. There were security challenges. We had no clue how to put something on a boat, the team that we were originally working with. So any one of those five things in a scarcity mindset was a showstopper. We can't pursue this. Putting on our GRGB behaviors, an abundance mindset, each of those things could be overcome. Hey, we have some friends at NOC 80 Wolf. They live in ship modification. They can help us through that. We know people in security that have a yes if mentality and can help us work through some of those challenges. We've got teammates in TSD, PMA 205, and industry who've integrated trainers before. Let's partner with them to make this possible. So you look at that, just setting the tone early on, putting the fleet first. We didn't have a formal requirement, but the fleet had a need. That's a good enough requirement for us. When you talk about changing the game, the team laid out a lot of things they did differently here. Attacking this as a collaborative team, elevating barriers in real time. The top cover from Admiral Chebby and Admiral Doherty was unmatched. And then you look at winning with inclusion and respect. That's where the teaming aspect really comes in. We didn't have the experience for shipboard mods. We knew a teammate who did. We couldn't deliver an E2 trainer. We had an industry partner who was willing to lean forward and do that. And so I think we really exemplified all the core operating principles of get real, get better. Now the magic is, how do we scale that to deliver again and again in the same fashion?
A reference back to what AJ and the captain said, about mid-March, we started the daily phone call. We did those daily phone calls with Knock Wolf and the team that was on the Lincoln for about 7 weeks. That looks like micromanaging from the outside looking in. But what it turned into was a daily opportunity for brainstorming. And one of the things that stands out in my mind that I laugh about now, the shelves. We had custom-built shelves, one-of-a-kind, long-lead item. You got to get these on the ship. And we were told that the ship was going to come back for 48 hours and go on deployment. To AJ's point, there were so many things to overcome. We couldn't get those shelves on the V-22 to get them out to the Lincoln. And without those shelves, V-2s have nothing to bolt to. And I think it was Air Force's, with Chad Sainer, threw out, why don't we unwrap it? So how many NAVAIR projects have you put aboard an AOE that sailed out, pulled next to an aircraft carrier at midnight on a Saturday night, and hung my precious shells on a line between the two ships to get them off of that ship and onto the carrier? And all I could think about was, they're going to drop those things in the Pacific Ocean. But now I had the mindset of, but then I'm going to have PAC Fleet go get a DSRV and go get my shells off the bottom of the ocean. We'll get them back on the Lincoln. But that brainstorming was very productive. And so what will look like micromanaging to anybody else turned into a really great opportunity. It also built that trust that the captain was referring to, right? But when we started having those conversations, and, you know, it was open, it was honest, it wasn't brutal, to Blaine's point, it was respectful, it started getting kind of fun. And there were some crazy ideas. Captain James, the CEO of NOC TSD, as it turns out, getting a cipher lock door for a classified space is a long lead item and almost impossible, apparently. Well, John Stennis was in the yards, or still is in the yards, and Captain James' buddy was the CEO of the Stennis, and so we were talking about cannibalizing a door off another aircraft carrier to put it on the Lincoln, and with the promise that they'd get a new door someday. That's a lot of out-of-the-box brainstorming that was going on, because we were what was apparently micromanaging. I love that part.
To build on that, Beaker, that's excellent. I think one of the core behaviors in that, we talked about missional alignment, but there's something that Admiral Chebby talks about, schedule is a key performance parameter. And that was absolutely true for everyone on this team. We had a delivery date we had to meet. That date got squeezed on both sides. We had things that were delaying us on the front end. The ship was going to deploy earlier than originally planned. The availability windows got smaller, but schedule was a KPP, and it forced out-of-the-box thinking. It forced us to get out of our comfort zone and do business differently. And so I think that was a very powerful GRGB behavior that this team exemplified every day, because every day mattered. And when we talk about scaling that across our command, the CNO talks about January 2027 being ready for significant conflict. Schedule is a KPP in every capability we deliver. It must be.
I think this is such an amazing example of certainly thinking differently. And Blaine, as you mentioned, having that abundance mindset, that how we will versus why we can't do something. So now I want to jump to your other point about scaling and scaling the learning. What did you learn when moving through this process, and how did you encourage learning throughout the process? Captain?
I'll hearken to a point I made earlier, right? The first part about learning is creating an environment where mistakes can be freely discussed, that there is transparency and trust. You've got to have the psychological safety with your coworkers in order to be able to bring up those things that are hard that you don't know how to do. It is a challenging thing for a lot of professionals to come forward and say, this is my area of expertise, and I am not sure how to solve this problem. That is a challenging thing to do, and that's something we need to do more of, because oftentimes those problems that are not discussed, they wind up being what gets discovered one day prior to delivery and setting you back for 6 months because we didn't discuss it 6 months ago when we could have done something about it. So I think building that sort of environment is key. It's got to be intentional. You got to build trust along the way. It is not natural that's a challenge. And I think leadership here, our leadership that we have up and down the chain from the PEO to the NOC and Nav Air side are really embracing this idea. I tell my folks this, I can go to my leadership and say, I don't know, or I have a problem and I don't know how to solve it. And they can do the same. And I don't feel like that person is going to feel like I am doing a bad job because I don't know how to solve this problem. But they are there to help figure out what the resources are, point us to other resources that could be of use. That is something that is definitely different, talking across organizational boundaries and building that transparency and trust.
Now, sir, as you got that leadership engagement, how did you encourage the team to elevate the barriers if they had them?
I think the most important thing was building the trust that, hey, if you often, I know I've been in the position where I've elevated stuff and it's like you threw something up and it came crashing down back on your head, right? As something a lot heavier than the weight that you passed up. And oftentimes that is our experience. That's a learned experience. I think what we have to do, all leaders within NAVAIR, is that we are accountable for those things. When folks bring us problems to solve, it is not for us to simply pass it back to them. And it's a real desire to work together, not to just put a heavier weight on. So,
yeah, I think the other piece of that was a shared ownership of the outcome. It wasn't it's not my problem, it's a NOC 80 Wolf problem. It's not my problem, it's a Collins Aero problem. No, we're all teammates in this. So there's no transactional relationship. It's shared accountability. And that was powerful.
Now, Blaine, when we talk get real, get better, what does that mean to you?
To me, get real, get better is really challenging the way we think, act, and operate both individually and as a greater team. And it's bringing that mindset to change the way we deliver capabilities to the warfighter.
Okay, for me, it's open, honest communication. I've always been the guy who said what everybody was thinking but was afraid to say, and I didn't know we had a name for it. It's also the fear of elevating, right? The captain really touched on that. And so you have to not be afraid, but you also, as the middle tier manager, create that environment that others won't be afraid. And then if you're talking to each other, you can't help but get real, get better. Because somebody's going to say what needs to be said if everybody's comfortable saying it.
All right. So what advice would you offer to other teams or other program offices facing similar challenges?
I will say one thing that we haven't touched on is that this was accomplished by taking things that were available and using them in new and different ways to create value. And I think if we are interested in delivering things in a short time period, that's the kind of mindset that we have to have. How do we use the capabilities that are present, but maybe use them in different ways, maybe align them differently? That can be the capability itself. It can be the teams itself, right? We put the different teams together and you can do new and different things. A lot of times it's not about going and getting something new, but it's using them in different ways.
So what feedback have you received from the fleet? And what would you say is the future of SIMS at Sea? Mark?
So we've been getting feedback from CAG9. So we had three of our engineers that helped do the integration and ride the ship from San Diego to Guam, about 5 weeks, I think. They were running it up every day. And CAG9's feedback's not all cherry. And we knew we had some issues because we did take a bunch of things that weren't necessarily designed to go together. We put them together. Renee's integration team did a great job getting that done. But Friday, I got an email from Captain Tritz, CAG9. It's working. So they have been able to make it work without engineering support. Basically, their ITs from the squadrons are playing the role of engineer. Not without difficulties. But we're going to attempt, you know, you ask what's next, what's the future? Short-term future is to get a facility that Renee can put her team back together and we can get some more of our toys and work on some of these bugs that we're starting to see. Easy buttons. The next ship will be the Carl Vincent, ironically, kind of where you started, because their schedule lends itself nicely to what we need to do. And we worked with Wolf. I went down to the Wolf facilities a couple weeks ago and we laid out all the carrier availabilities and what would be the best next boat. So there are going to be other ships. CAGs are calling the Commodores asking, when am I next? Because the captain went and socialized it to everybody. So they want it. Big demand signal. That helps. That's where maybe other programs can't recreate some of the magic we created because they want it so bad. But there definitely is a future. It's going to be a lot bigger than it is now. They need more trainers than we gave them. to do what they really need to do. So that requires a bigger space. So I'm pretty excited about that. It's pretty neat stuff. And that's kind of what I'm proud of, is that we've started something that we're touching the face of training. And what I said earlier, it's they can't do this without these trainers. They can't train this stuff in the real airplane. So that is the future of Sims at Sea.
To expound upon what Beaker just said, one of the true boons for this effort was having our lead engineer go on the boat and interface directly with the customers, the guys using it. And I got to say, from a collaboration perspective, like, I think being that close to the customers are what drove such success here. But being out there with them, he was able to see exactly how they use it. What John learned while being out on the Abraham Lincoln was sometimes aircrew just pop in. Their flight didn't take off for whatever reason. They want to hop in. Our simulation control executive isn't really designed for that. So we would like to now go and change how we bring up sims to bring up a constant number of them so that as many trainers as there are, that's how many we'll bring up, and they can just hop in when ready. He learned probably, I don't know, a dozen or more things like that that we're now going to add to the Sims at Sea capability going forward. So it was just a great effort to be able to not only give them what they need, but to learn how to give them even better stuff in the future.
The fleet was amazing during this time period. They supported our testing in the midst of workups, which is pretty grueling for anybody that's been through workups at home, away. They took time out of their at-home time to come down to San Diego and be there with the team to make this capability better. Just to show the support that we got from the fleet, that they were willing to do that, to take time out of their workup schedule, it really is a testament to us all working together, not just one side of it, but the users and the folks producing it really made it happen.
All right, Blaine, as we wrap today's podcast, tell me, what aspects of this project are you the most proud of?
I am the most proud that CVN-72 is on the way to a conflict zone, and these people at the table and the teams they lead delivered a capability to make them more ready for that conflict. That's why we do what we do every day. It doesn't get any more real than that. So I appreciate that we've got an incredible team that made our sailors more ready.
100% agree. So I want to thank all of you for joining us today to talk about Sims at Sea, how you focused on the fleet, identified gaps, came up with a plan, removed barriers, collaborated across teams to establish a new standard for at-sea training. This is an absolutely amazing example of Get Real, Get Better success. Of course, if you want to learn about more GRGB efforts going on across our organization, check out the Airwaves podcast on all your favorite listening apps. And that's it for this edition of Airwaves. Thanks for listening.